copper scabs catching on the brow ridge and tearing away. Victor trades a look with his partner. "Grab the coat," he says, pushing back from the table.
"What?"
"We're going to take a little ride."
"We're doing what?"
Edison mutters. The girl doesn't ask any questions, simply takes his jacket and shrugs into it. The little blue dragon stays in one hand. He leads them down into the garage, opening the front passenger door for the girl. She looks at the car for a moment, her mouth crooked in an expression he can't really call a smile. "Something wrong?"
"Except for coming here and to the hospital, and presumably from New York to the garden, I haven't been in a car since the taxi heading to my grand's."
"Then you'll understand if I don't offer to let you drive." Her lips twitch. The easy laughter and comfortable atmosphere they'd finally achieved in the room is gone, vanished in the face of what they've been working toward all along.
"Is there a reason I have to sit in the back?" Edison complains.
"Would you like me to invent one?"
"Fine, but I get to pick the music."
"No." The girl arches an eyebrow, and Victor grimaces.
"He likes country." "Please don't let him pick," she says pleasantly as she slides into the seat.
Chuckling, he waits for her legs to be clear before he closes the door.
"Where are we going for our little field trip?"
Edison asks as the men cross to the other side of the car. "First stop is coffee. Then we're going to the hospital."
"So she can check on the girls?"
"That too." Rolling his eyes, Edison lets it go and settles into the back seat. When they arrive at the hospital, coffee's in hand, tea for Inara, the entire building is surrounded with news vans and gawkers. The part of him that's been doing this job for too long wonders if every parent who's ever lost a girl between 16 and 18 is out there with a candle and a blown-up picture, hoping for the best. Or maybe even hoping for the worst, so long as the nightmare of not knowing is finally over. Some stare at their cell phones, waiting for a call that, for many, will never come.
"Are the rooms blocked off for the girls?"
she asks, angling her face away from the passenger window and letting her hair fall forward to hide her further. "Yes, with guards at the doors." He squints ahead at the emergency entrance to see if he can get away with bringing her in through there, but four ambulances fill the bay with a flurry of activity around them.
"I can walk past a few reporters if I need to. They can't honestly expect me to talk about it."
"Did you ever watch the news in the city?"
"We caught it every now and then at Takis when we were getting food,"
she answers with a shrug.
"We didn't have a TV, and most of the people we hung out with only had their sets hooked into game platforms or DVD players. Why?"
"Because they do expect you to talk about it, even when they know you're not allowed to. They will shove their microphones in your face and ask you personal questions with no sensitivity, and they'll share your answers with anyone who cares to listen."
"So they're like the FBI?
"First Hitler, now reporters," Edison says. "I'm thrilled you have such a high opinion of us."
"I clearly don't know enough about reporters to find them offensive, so I don't know that it's too terrible."
"If you don't mind wading through them, we can head in," Victor says before either of them can add anything else. He parks the car and walks around to open the door for her. "They're going to be yelling," he cautions her. "They'll be loud and in your face, and there will be cameras flashing everywhere. There will be parents asking questions about their girls, wanting to know if you've seen them. And there'll be people insulting you."
"Insulting me?
There are always some people who feel that the victim must have deserved it," he explains. "They're idiots, but they're often vocal. Of course you don't deserve it. No one deserves to get kidnapped or raped or murdered, but they'll say it anyway because they believe it, or because they want a few seconds of attention.
And because we protect free speech, we can't do anything about it. I guess I grew so used to the horrors of the garden, I forgot how awful outside could be. He'd give anything to tell her that it isn't true. But it is, so he stays silent. They walk out of the garage to the main entrance, the agents flanking the girl protectively, and the lights and sounds rise to a fever pitch. The girl ignores them with grave dignity, staring straight ahead, refusing to even listen to the questions, much less answer them. There are barricades to keep everyone back from the path to the hospital, with local police manning them. They're almost to the doors when one enterprising woman crawls under the barricade and between an officer's legs, her microphone cord trailing behind her.
"What is your name? Are you one of the victims?"
she demands, waving her mic in front of her. The girl doesn't answer, doesn't even look at her, and Victor signals for the officer to take the woman away.
"With a tragedy such as this, you owe the public the full story."
Her thumb still rubs thoughtfully against the little blue dragon, but she turns to look at the reporter who struggles against the officer's grip on her arms.
"I think if you actually knew anything about the case you're claiming to report," she says softly, "you'd have better sense than to suggest I owe anyone a thing."
She nods to the officer and resumes her progress to the sliding doors. Cries follow her, those closest to the door, asking after missing girls. But everything fades to a dull roar when the doors hiss shut behind them. Edison actually grins at the girl.
"I was expecting you to tell her to fuck off."
"I thought about it," she admits. "Then I remembered that you two were likely to be in the frame. And I didn't want Hanoverian's mother to wash his ears out for hearing such filthy language."
"Yeah, yeah. Come on, children."
For a hospital, there's a significant police presence, even in the main lobby. FBI, local police, representatives from other police departments, child services, all of them talking on phones or clicking away on laptops or tablets. Those not tied into the technology are dealing with something far more difficult, the families. As Edison drops their empty cups into the bin by the doors, Victor waves to the third member of their team, seated beside a couple in their mid-30s. Ramirez nods, but doesn't take her arm from around the shoulders of the exhausted woman next to her.
"Inara, this is..."
"Agent Ramirez,"
Inara finishes for him.
"We met before I got taken away. She promised to keep the doctors from being assholes."
Victor winces. Ramirez smiles.
"Overbearing," she corrects. "I promised to try to keep them from being overbearing, though I think you were Maya then."
"I was."
"Am?"
She shakes her head.
"It's complicated." "These are Keeley's parents," says Ramirez, gesturing to the couple.
"She keeps asking for you,"
says Keeley's father. He's pale and red-eyed, but he offers his hand to shake. She holds up her burned, gashed hands in silent apology.
"I understand you helped protect her once she was there."
"I tried," she hedges. "Not that she's lucky to have been there, but it's fortunate she wasn't there long."
"We were going to have her move to a private room,"
his wife adds through a sniffle. She clutches a Hello Kitty backpack and a handful of tissues.
"She's so young, and the questions the doctors are asking are so personal."
She trails off into her tissues, and her husband picks up the thread.
"She panicked, said if she couldn't have you, she wanted to stay
with Donnell and Bliss?"
"Yes, I don't understand why she would..."
"This is all an awful lot to take in,"
Inara tells them gently.
"It's frightening. Keeley wasn't in there long, but for those couple of days she wasn't alone. The three of us were with her the entire time, and often some of the other girls as well. It's comforting to be with people who know exactly what you've gone through." It'll get better.
She glances down at the dragon in her hand.
It's not that she's not over the moon to see you. She is. She missed you terribly. But being alone in a room right now is likely to cause her panic. Just be patient with her.
What did they do to our little girl?
She'll tell you that as she can. Just be patient with her,
she repeats.
And I'm sorry, I know you must have a million questions and concerns, but I really need to go check on the others, including Keeley.
Right, of course. Keeley's father clears his throat several times. Thank you for helping her. His wife stands and embraces the startled girl, who throws a wary look at the grinning Victor. When he makes no move to help, she grimaces and gently pulls away from the woman's arms.
How many other parents are here?
She mutters as they walk away.
About half of the survivors, with a few more on the way,
Ramirez answers, jogging to catch up with them by the elevators.
They haven't notified any of the parents of the dead girls yet. They want to be absolutely sure it's them. That would be good, yes.
Agent Ramirez,
calls a strident voice, followed by the swift clicks of heels on tile. Victor groans. They were so close to passing unnoticed. But he turns, along with his partners, to face the approaching woman. Inara just keeps looking at the screen above the elevator, watching the numbers descend. Senator Kingsley is an elegant woman in her 50s, her black hair arranged around her face to give an impression of softness that her severe expression counteracts. She still looks fresh despite having been at the hospital since last night. Her crisp red suit is striking against her dark skin, a small American flag pin on her lapel nearly drowned by the color.
This is her, then? She demands, stopping in front of them. This is the girl you've been hiding?
We've been interviewing her, Senator, not hiding her, Victor says mildly. He reaches out to grip Inara's shoulder, gently but firmly turning her around. Inara's eyes flick over the woman. She musters a smile so obviously fake it makes him wince.
You must be Ravenna's mother.
Her name, the senator says tightly, is Patrice.
It was, Inara agrees, and it will be. Right now it's still Ravenna. Outside isn't real yet. And just what the hell does that mean?
The smile disappears. Inara's thumb rubs against the sad dragon. After a moment she straightens and looks the woman in the eye.
It means you're too real for her to handle yet. The past 2 days have been too much. We've spent so long living in someone else's terrible fantasy that we don't know how to be real anymore. It'll come in time. But your real is very...
She glances at the knot of aides and staff members hovering a respectful distance away.
Very public, she says finally. If you can get rid of the entourage, maybe it'll be easier for her.
We're just trying to get to the bottom of this.
Isn't that the FBI's job?
The senator stares at her.
She's my daughter. I'm not just going to sit by and watch.
Like every other parent?
Victor winces again.
You stand for the law, Senator. Sometimes that means standing back to let it work.
Edison spins to hit the call button for the elevator again. Victor can see his shoulders shaking. But Inara isn't done yet.
Sometimes it means being mother or senator, not both. I think she'd like to see her mother. But with what she's been through, the adjustments she'll have to make, I don't think she can handle the senator. Now, if you'll please excuse us, we need to check in on Ravenna and the others.
The elevator dings and she steps through as soon as the doors open.
Ramirez and Edison join her. Victor waves them up. The senator may be speechless for the moment, but that never seems to last long. And it doesn't.
I've been informed that that woman, Lorraine, was complicit in what was done to my daughter. I promise you, Agent, if I hear even the slightest hint that that girl is part of this, I will bring the full weight. Senator, let us do our job. If you want to know what happened to your daughter, if you want to get to the truth, you have to let us do our job.
He reaches out to touch her elbow. I have a daughter only a little younger than Patrice. I promise you, this is not something I take lightly. They are incredibly strong young women who have been through hell, and I will honor them by giving them my best. But you have to take a step away.
Could you? She asks shrewdly.
I hope I never find out.
God help you, Agent, if this blows up in your face.
Victor watches her walk away, then hits the up button. As he waits for the elevator, he can see her rejoin her knot of people, giving orders and asking questions. Her younger staff members scrambling to respond, the older ones are steadier, less overwhelmed. He rides up to the fourth floor and steps out into the noticeable hush, so different from the crammed and frantic lobby. The others have waited for him. A cluster of doctors and nurses talk at the nurses' station, but the presence of armed guards at the doors keeps the volume down. One of the nurses waves at Ramirez.
Need to talk to the girls again? We have someone else who needs to see them.
She points to the girl, and the nurse follows her gesture with an easy smile.
Ah, yes, I remember you. How are your hands doing?
She holds them up for the nurse's inspection.
The stitches are clean, and there's no swelling, she murmurs. That's a good thing. Are you picking at the scabs from the smaller wounds? A little? Well, don't do it any more. You want these to heal. Let's get some bandages on these just in case.
Within minutes, her hands are once again wrapped in gauze that's carefully taped around her fingers to allow for some mobility. As long as the nurse has her stationary anyway, she does a quick check of the smaller injuries on her side and arm.
You look good, sweetie, the woman concludes, one hand on her shoulder. Agent, you can take her now.
The girl salutes, making the nurse wave her off with a smile. As they come to the first of the doors, Inara takes a slow breath, pulling the little blue dragon back out for comfort.
I can't guess what the dynamic is going to be, she confesses.
Victor pats her shoulder. Go and find out. The local officer standing guard awkwardly shifts his weight.
They're all two doors down.
All? Edison asks sharply.
They insisted.
They being the traumatized young women?
Yes, sir.
He pulls off his hat to scratch at his flyaway blonde hair.
One of them taught me a few phrases I've never heard, even on drug busts.
Probably bliss, murmurs the girl. Rather than argue with the man, she simply walks down another two doors, followed belatedly by the trio of agents, and nods to the officer at that post.
May I go in?
He glances to the agents, who all nod.
Yes, ma'am.
Though individual words and voices are indistinct, they can hear the sound of conversation through the wall. It stops as soon as the door swings open, then peaks when the inhabitants of the room see the girl.
Maya!
A black-and-white, bare-assed blur flies across the room and into the girl's arms.
Where the fuck have you been? Hello, Bliss.
Patting the smaller girl's messy black curls, she looks around the room. Somehow the two-bed room has four beds in it. All of the walking wounded are clustered on the beds of the more seriously injured, holding hands or sitting with arms around shoulders or waists. A few of the braver parents sit on hard chairs beside the beds. but most of them are clustered against the far wall, talking amongst themselves, while still keeping an eye on their daughters. Victor leans against the wall with a smile, watching the smallest shadow creep between two of the beds to work her way between the two young women. It's a joy to see the girl's gentle smile, how tightly she holds the child against her.
"Hello, Keely. I met your parents." "I think I heard them,"
whispers Keely, but Inara shakes her head.
"They're just scared. Be patient with them, and be patient with yourself."
Victor and his partners hover near the door for nearly an hour, watching the young women laugh and toss jokes and insults back and forth as they comfort the occasional breakdown or tears. Despite her obvious distaste for it, the girl allows herself to be introduced to the parents. She listens to them patiently as they tell her all about their searches for their daughters, how they never gave up hope, and the only sign of her cynicism is the cocked eyebrow that sends Danelle into giggles strong enough to set off her heart monitor. Ravenna, he can identify. She looks like a younger version of her mother, and he watches their short conversation intently, wishing he could hear any of it. The senator's daughter has bandages wrapped around most of one leg. Ravenna's the dancer, he remembers. As Inara gently touches the bandages, he wonders how this will affect that. He can name some of the other butterflies from her stories. For others, he has to listen for the names they toss around, try to pin them to their owners. With the exception of Keely, never renamed, none of them use their original names. It's still the names from the garden on their tongues, on their minds. And he can see the parents cringe every time. Inara said that sometimes it was easier to forget. For the first time, he wonders if any of them did. Or perhaps she's right and they're not ready for this to be real yet. It's tempting to stay there longer, to bask in the sight, to push back some of the horrors of the past few days. But Victor can't relax into it completely. There's more she has to see, and more she has yet to tell them. More they need to know. He lifts his wrist to check his watch, and immediately Inara's eyes are on him, a question that doesn't need words. He nods. She sighs, closing her eyes for a moment to collect herself, then starts the process of reassuring everyone she'll be back. She's almost back to the door when Bliss catches her hand.
"How much have you told them?"
she asks bluntly.
"Most of what's important." "And what have they told you?" "Avery's dead. The gardener is likely to survive to stand trial." "So we'll all have to talk." "It's time. And look at it this way. Maybe the FBI will be easier to tell than your parents."
Bliss grimaces.
"Her parents are on their way," Ramirez whispers to Victor, flying over the Atlantic from her father's new teaching position in Paris. "It's hard to tell whether they gave up looking for her, or if they simply had to do what was best for the children they still had."
From her expression, it's clear Bliss isn't inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt. With a last hug for Keely, Inara leaves the room with Victor and Edison. Ramirez remains behind to talk with the parents. They pass a string of empty rooms with guards at the doors, all the rooms the girls are supposed to be in but aren't. Then a run of unoccupied rooms that form a buffer between the girls and the rooms at the far end of the hall, with their own guards. When they stop, Edison glances in the door's small window and shoots his partner a curious look. Victor simply nods.
"I'll wait out here," the younger man says.
Victor opens the door, ushers the girl through, and closes it carefully behind them. The man on the bed is hooked into an unbelievable array of machines, all beeping softly with their own sounds and rhythms. A nasal cannula feeds oxygen into his system, but an intubation kit stands nearby for the very real possibility of being needed. Dressings obscure much of what the blanket doesn't cover, some of them bandages,
some of them glistening salves and synthetic materials to draw the heat out of the burns and prevent infection. The burns extend to one side of his scalp, a bubbling mess of discolored, blistered skin. The girl stares at him with wide eyes, her feet rooted barely a yard inside the room. His name is Jeffrey McIntosh, Victor tells her gently. He isn't the gardener anymore. He has a name and a host of disfiguring injuries, and he isn't the god of the garden anymore. He never will be again. His name is Jeffrey McIntosh, and he'll be brought to trial for everything he's done. This man cannot hurt you anymore.
What about Eleanor, his wife? She whispers.
She's in the next room so they can monitor her heart. She collapsed at the house. As far as we can tell, she never knew about any of this.
And Lorraine?
A few doors down, she's being questioned to determine the extent to which she can be charged for her part in all of this. There will be a number of psychological evaluations before that's decided. He can see the name take shape on her lips, but she doesn't ask. She sinks down into one of the hard chairs against the wall, leaning forward against her knees to study the unconscious man in the hospital bed.
None of us had ever seen him so angry, she says in a tiny voice. Not even for all the harm that Avery caused. He was furious.
He offers her his hand and tries to hide his surprise when she actually takes it, the gauze rubbing against his skin.
None of us had ever seen him like that.
The three of them stood at the far end of the garden, closest to the door, and the gardener had clearly flipped his shit. He was screaming at Desmond, and there was Avery looking smug as hell. I guess he figured his father wasn't too upset about Keeley anymore. Rather than move closer, I inspected what I could see of the garden. There had been people there, that much was clear. Footprints were visible in the sand, and some of the plants were trampled. Someone had even left a gum wrapper on the stream bank. Had the officers just been incurious? Had the gardener given them an explanation that made sense? The dimensions, whispered Bliss. If he brought down all the walls, they may not have realized there were hallways. There are tracks on both sides of the main doorway. So maybe they had looked, and just couldn't find us. Desmond had actually made the call. My heart hurt because I wanted to be proud of him, but really, all I could think was it's about fucking time. Knowing we were kidnapped, violated, murdered, and displayed wasn't enough, but at least the raped and brutalized 12-year-old finally was. This is wrong, he cried when his father finally took a breath. Taking them is wrong, keeping them is wrong, and killing them is wrong. That is not your decision to make. Yes, it is, because it's against the law. His father slapped him so hard, he stumbled back and fell. This is my home and my garden. Here I am the law, and you went against that. Laughing like a little boy at Christmas, Avery disappeared and came back only moments later with a bamboo cane, probably the same one that had been used on him the day before. Seriously, a cane. Who the fuck canes their grown children? Actually, who canes their children at any age? But Avery handed the cane to his father and tackled his younger brother, tearing at his clothing until his back and part of his ass were bare. This is for your own good, Desmond, the gardener said as he rolled up his sleeves. Desmond struggled, but Avery tucked him into a headlock. With Keeley's face pressed to my stomach so she couldn't see, we stood and watched as the gardener beat his son with the cane. It left bright red marks that quickly swelled into welts, and Avery, the sick fuck, cheered with every impact. Desmond continued to struggle, but didn't cry out, despite how much it had to hurt. The gardener counted them out, and after 20 blows, he tossed the bamboo away from him. Avery's cheers stopped. That's it? He demanded. You gave me that many for branding the bitch! I pressed a hand against my hip and felt the thick scar tissue left from that brand. Were 20 blows of a cane equivalent? Avery, stay out of this, No, he could have put us both in prison, on death row even, and you let him off with 20? He dropped his brother to the sandy path and got back to his feet. He nearly destroyed everything you've been working toward for 30 years! He turned his back on what it means to be your son. He turned his back on you! Avery, I told you. Avery pulled something from the back of his belt, and suddenly it didn't matter what his father had told him. Avery had the room. A gun will do that. You gave him everything, he yelled, pointing the gun at his brother. Your precious Desmond, who never did a thing to help you stock the garden, and you were so damn proud of him. The butterflies like him. He doesn't hurt them. He understands them better. Who gives a shit? I'm your son, too. Your firstborn. I'm the one you're supposed to be proud of. His father held his hands up, staring at the gun. Avery, I was always proud of you. No, you were scared of me. Even I know the difference in that, father. Avery, please put the gun down. There's no place for that here. There's no place for that here, he echoed with a sneer. That's what you've always said about anything I wanted. With a deep, pained groan, Desmond rolled onto his back and propped himself up on his elbows. The gun went off. Desmond fell back to the path with a cry, blood blooming across the breast of his tattered shirt. The gardener lurched forward with a sob, and the gun went off again, and the gardener fell to his knees, clutching his side. I thrust Keeley at Danelle and shoved them both down behind a boulder. Stay here, I hissed. Liz grabbed my hand. Is he worth it? Probably not, I admitted. But he did call. With a sad shake of her head, she let go, and I raced forward from the clutch of girls. I was almost to Desmond when Avery grabbed me by the hair and yanked me off my feet. And here's the bitch herself, the little queen of the garden! He pistol-whipped me so hard my ears rang, and part of the gun sliced my cheek with the impact. Dropping the gun, he kicked me onto my knees and fumbled at his belt. Well, I'm the king of the garden now, so you'd better learn to show me some respect. You put that near my mouth and I'll bite it off, I snarled. And from behind the boulder, Bliss cheered. He hit me again and again and raised his hand to do it once more when Nazira's voice stopped him. I can hear sirens! I couldn't hear anything but the bells going off inside my skull, but some of the other girls said they could hear them too. I wasn't sure if they were trying to distract him or if the sirens were real. Avery dropped me and ran through the garden to take the path up the cliff to see for himself. I crawled to Desmond, who was trying to keep pressure on his chest with one hand. I moved his hands away and did it myself, his blood warm and sticky as it pumped against my palm. Please don't die, I whispered. He weakly squeezed my hand, but otherwise didn't try to answer. The gardener groaned and pulled himself to his son's other side.
Desmond! Desmond, answer me!
The pale green eyes, his father's eyes, fluttered open.
The only way to protect them from him is to let them go, he panted.
Sweat beaded his face.
He'll kill them all, and they'll be in pain at every moment. Just stay awake, Desmond, his father pleaded. We'll get you to the hospital, and we'll figure this out. Maya, keep pressure on it.
I hadn't stopped. But now I could hear the sirens. Avery jumped and swore atop the cliff, and the girls raced forward to surround us, probably figuring the gardener and Desmond were a safer bet than Avery off the deep end. Even Lorraine was clustered with us, and no one tried to brush her away. Liz picked up the gun with shaking hands, but she kept her eyes trained on Avery. And the sirens got louder.
I can't figure out why they came back, she whispers, clutching his hand for dear life. They didn't find anything the first time, right? Or the gardener wouldn't have lifted the walls.
One of the officers who stayed at the station ran the names Desmond gave over the phone. Keeley's name they recognized because she was so recently missing. But when he ran some of the others, FBI flags came up on the search. His supervisor contacted us and we met them back out there. Cassidy Lawrence, for example. She went missing almost 7 years ago from Connecticut. There's no reason to say her name with Keeley's unless there's actually a connection between them.
So Lionette was part of why we were finally found? she asks with a faint smile. Yes, she was. They sit in silence for a few minutes, watching the man on the bed breathe in and out. Inara?
The rest of it.
Hopefully, this is the last difficult thing I'll have to ask of you.
Until you ask me to take the stand.
She sighs. I'm sorry, I truly am, but what happened next?
Fucking Sirvat. The gardener pulled the remote control thing out of his pocket and punched a series of numbers into the tiny pad on it. Sirvat, please go into the room right by the door and get some towels and rubber tubing.
The one by Zara? She asked.
Yes, that's the one.
A slow smile spread across her face, and she spun away with a laugh. Sirvat had been there about a year and a half. And as long as I'd known her, she'd been solitary and just odd. The gardener adjusted his belt to put pressure on the wound in his side and stroked his son's hair, telling him to stay awake, asking him questions and begging him to respond. Des squeezed my hand in response to some things, and he was still breathing. But he didn't try to talk, which I thought was probably for the better.
When we get the towels tied on him, will you let us take him out the front? I asked.
The gardener just looked at me, nearly through me, seemingly weighing his butterflies against his son, even now. Finally he nodded. Then I smelled it and froze. Danelle was the next to smell it, her nose wrinkling.
What is that?
Formaldehyde, I hissed.
We need to get away from that room.
What room? The gardener paled even more.
No questions now, ladies. Come.
We had to drag Desmond across the sand, the gardener stumbling and swaying after us. We splashed through the waterfall. Anyone who tried to go behind it and stay dry got pushed in by Bliss and crowded into the cave. Over the sound of the waterfall, we heard Sirvat laughing, and then...
She shakes her head.
I don't know how to describe the explosion, she tells him. It was just massive. All this sound and heat. A few of the rocks came down from the top of the cliff, but the cave didn't collapse like I was half afraid it would. There were flames and glass everywhere, and all these stupid little sprinklers misting straight into steam. Air poured in from the shattered roof, and the flames leaped toward them. Smoke poured out, along with the real butterflies. But even with that, the smoke was so thick we could hardly breathe. We had to get out of there.
You went through the stream?
Until we reached the pond. Our feet got cut up pretty badly from the glass, but the flames were spreading and the water seemed like a better option. The front half of the garden was just this huge blaze. I asked the gardener...
She swallows hard. Looks at the man in the bed.
I asked Mr. McIntosh if there was an emergency exit, any other way to get out, but he said he never thought anything would happen.
She twists her hand in his grip until her other hand can reach underneath the bandages to touch the scabs. He gently pushes it away.
The flames were spreading so fast. Panes of glass shattered overhead, raining down on us in chunks and shards. Willa dodged one, but stepped directly into another that cut her head almost in half. We could see the flames beyond the glass, eating into the outer greenhouse. The gardener shook his head, leaning on Haley for support.
If it reaches the room with the fertilizers, there will be a second explosion, he said, coughing.
By now most of the girls were crying. I tried to think of any possible way we weren't trapped and fucked.
The cliff, I said. If we break some of the glass on the wall, we could go out onto the roof of the halls. And what, slide down the breaking or broken panes of glass for the outer greenhouse? Muttered Bliss. And still probably break ankles, legs, spines when we land? Fine, your turn. No fucking clue, your turn.
Desmond chuckled, then groaned. Pia screamed, and we spun around to see Avery behind her, his burned and blistered forearm across her throat. A chunk of glass quivered in his shoulder. Soot and gashes streaking down his cheeks. He laughed and bit her neck as she struggled against him.
Avery, let her go,
the gardener moaned. The Despite the roar of the flames, we heard her neck snap. He threw her body to the side and then jerked back from a sharp crack. I turned to see Bliss with the gun up, her feet planted, and she shot him again. He bellowed with pain and threw himself forward, and she squeezed off two more shots until he finally fell face first in the flowers. One of the larger trees, all its branches aflame, snapped near its roots and crashed into the wall with a terrific groan. Glass shattered, metal panes snapping under its weight, and the black roof that ran between the two sections of greenhouse collapsed beneath it. We could see the outer greenhouse through the dancing flames.
"I still have nothing," Bliss said, and choked on the smoke. "Really, it's still your turn to think of something."
"Fuck off," I muttered, and she gave me a weak grin. I hooked my ankle around Ravenna's knee and pulled her to take my place, pressing against Desmond's chest. With how much we were moving him, I didn't think it would do any good, but I couldn't bear not to at least try. He'd tried, even if he hadn't succeeded. We could try. And I didn't want him to die, not when he'd finally given us a chance to live. I ran to the fallen tree, tugging away the larger chunks of glass and the more jagged branches. Pain seared through my hands, but if there was even the chance of this being the way out, I had to try. Then Glennis and Marenka were helping me, and then Isra joined us, and we tried to dig away around the trunk. We were able to clear one side of it, and with all four of us pushing and straining from the other side, we managed to push the trunk just far enough into the outer greenhouse. Marenka tugged a piece of glass from my arm and flicked it away. "I think I know a way to carry him through. Let's try it." She lifted Desmond by the shoulders, hooking her hands under his armpits. I stood between his legs and hooked my hands under his knees. It wasn't graceful, and it certainly wasn't easy, but we were more or less single file. Bliss led the way through, Danelle and Keeley close behind her. Isra stayed back, pushing aside more debris as it fell, the gardener beside her. Not helping, because he couldn't, really, but getting the more frightened or frozen girls to follow us. The smoke was getting worse, getting thicker, and we were all choking on it. Figures moved beyond the outer greenhouse, and suddenly a great crack ran along one of the 6-foot panes that butted the floor. Someone was swinging an axe at it. We held back, waiting to see if they would get through, and after a few more hits, the center of the pane shattered. Using the axe head, a fireman knocked the rest of the glass out of the pane and threw down a heavy folded tarp over the chunks.
"Come on!"
he... "She?" yelled through the mask. Other firemen followed, and two of them took Desmond from us. It wasn't particularly fresh, but we got the first free air we'd had in forever, and the few girls who weren't crying already started as they stepped onto crisp autumn grass and felt the cold air wrap around us. Some of them fell to their knees in shock and had to be dragged away. I was trying to count heads after they took Desmond, and I could see Isra doing the same thing in the outer greenhouse, both of us trying to figure out how many we'd lost before we reached this point. Then there was this whump, and another explosion billowed out from one of the rooms. And the last I saw of Isra, she was flying sideways in a ball of fire, three of the others still clinging to her, the gardener on the ground with flames dancing over him. I tried to run to the girls, but one of the firemen grabbed my wrist and yanked me away.
"And then the ambulances and the hospital and the room where I met you," she sighs. "And that's it, the whole story."
"Not quite." She closes her eyes, bringing the hand with a little blue dragon to her cheek.
"My name."
"The gardener has his name now. Is yours really so terrible?" She doesn't answer. He stands and brings her to his feet. "Come on, one more thing to see." She follows him out the door, passing by a frowning Edison talking to a scene tech in a windbreaker, and into the door across the hall. This time he takes her all the way to the bedside before she can see who it is, and when she does, her breath hitches. Desmond's eyes open slowly, unfocused from drugs. But when he sees her, a faint smile curves his lips.
"Hey,"
he whispers. She has to shape the word several times before her voice catches up to the impulse.
Hey. I'm sorry. No, no, you did the right thing. But I should have done it a lot sooner.
His hand moves atop the blanket, plastic tubing curling under the tape, keeping the needle under his skin. She moves as if to take his hand, but her fingers clench into a fist before they touch him. She stares at him, mouth slightly open, her lower lip quivering with shock. His eyes slowly close as he falls still. Asleep or unconscious is anyone's guess. He's still weak, Victor says quietly. He has a long recovery ahead of him, but the doctors say he's probably out of the woods.
He's going to make it,
she whispers. Her eyes gleam wetly, but no tears fall. Clutching the little blue dragon in one hand, she folds her arms across her stomach, a sense of protection she shouldn't need anymore.
He'll be tried as complicit,
she says eventually. That isn't up to us. There may be a deal of some sort for him, but...
But he should have called 6 months earlier, and soon everyone will know it.
Victor scratches at his scalp. I admit I thought you'd be more relieved to see him alive.
I am. It's just...
Complicated? She nods.
It might have been kinder to leave him without the consequences of his cowardice. It was far too little and far too late. But he finally did the right thing, and now he'll be punished for taking so long. Maybe he could have died brave, but he'll live a coward.
So it never became real?
Real enough to leave scars, so not very real at all. How could it have been more?
He'll very likely stand trial to some degree. You will probably be called to testify against him. Still looking at the young man in the bed, she doesn't answer. He's not sure there's anything to say. Inara.
Inara!
Calls a female voice from the hall.
Yes, I see your badge, you arrogant bastard, but that's my family in there. Inara!
There are sounds of a scuffle. Then the door slams open to frame a woman of average height and maybe 30 years old or so, faded auburn hair threatening to tumble from a scraped-together bun. Inara freezes partway through turning to the intruder, her eyes impossibly wide. Her voice creeps out as little more than a breath.
Sophia.
Sophia runs into the room. But Inara meets her halfway, and the two of them cling to each other with white-knuckled grips. They sway from side to side from the force of the embrace. The Sophia? The apartment mother? How did she even know Inara was here? A thunder-faced Edison stalks into the room, glaring at the woman as he passes. He thrusts a plain black scrapbook, thick with pages, into Victor's hands. It was in a locked hidden drawer in his office desk. The techs were running the names when they found something interesting. Victor almost doesn't want to know, but this is his job. Tearing his eyes away from the two women, he sees a green sticky note fluttering from the edge about two-thirds of the way through. He opens to a few pages before it. A young woman with terrified, tearful eyes stares back at him from a photo. Shoulders hunched and hands partly raised, as if caught in the process of trying to hide her naked breasts from the camera. Beside it, a picture from behind, showing fresh wings. Beneath it, those same wings in a fresh display case, the crisp edges of the wings blurred by the glass and colorless resin. In the empty space there are two names, Lydia Anderson, on top, and below, Siobhan. In a firm masculine hand, followed by Gulf Fritillary, and dates 4 years apart. The next page has a different girl, and the one after, the one with the sticky, has only two pictures, and only one date.
Beneath the picture of an auburn-haired beauty with wary hazel eyes, the writing says, "Sophia Madsen." Victor reads aloud, stunned. The woman looks at him over Inara's shoulder. She says the next line for him.
"Lara." How? No one would have talked of a butterfly escaping if one never had.
Inara mumbles into Sophia's hair.
It would have hurt too badly.
The escape was real. You escaped? They both nod. Edison scowls.
The tech analysts typed in the name, and it hit against our list of Evening Star employees. They sent someone to the restaurant, and both listed residences, but she wasn't there.
Of course I wasn't, retorts Sophia. How could I be there when I was already on my way here?
She pulls back from Inara, doesn't let go, just steps back enough to take all of her in. Sophia's shirt is worn and over-large, the gaping neck sliding down one shoulder to reveal a bra strap and the edge of a faded wingtip stretched with gained weight.
Taki saw you on the news, being brought into the hospital, and he ran to the apartment to get everyone. They called me, and, oh, Inara!
Inara wheezes in Sophia's renewed embrace, but doesn't ask her to let go.
Are you all right?
Asks Sophia.
I will be,
Inara replies quietly, almost shyly.
My hands are the worst, but if I'm careful, they should heal. That's not all I'm asking, and I am asking. I have my own place now. I can break the apartment rules.
Inara's face lights up, all the uncertainty and shock vanishing.
You got your girls back? I did, and they'll be so glad to see you. They've missed you as much as the rest of us. They say no one reads to them as well as you do.
Edison doesn't quite manage to turn his laugh into a cough. Inara gives him a sour look. For his part, Victor's almost relieved to see her sidestep the more probing question. At least, she does it with everyone. He clears his throat to get their attention.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have to insist on an explanation.
He usually does,
Inara mutters. Sophia just smiles.
It's pretty much his job, but perhaps...
She glances over at the boy in the bed, Victor's eyes following. Desmond hasn't so much as twitched in all the noise.
Elsewhere?
Victor nods and leads them out of the room. In the hallway, he can see Senator Kingsley standing alone in front of the door to the butterfly's room, taking deep breaths. She should look softer in just the blouse and skirt. Instead, she just looks scared. Victor wonders if her suit is like Inara's lip gloss, a way to armor up against the rest of the world.
You think she'll go in?
Inara asks. Eventually, he answers, once she realizes this isn't something she can be ready for. He takes them into a room in the buffer zone between the butterflies and the McIntosh family. It's private at any rate, and one of the guards shifts down to make sure they're not disturbed. Inara and Sophia settle side by side on one of the stripped beds, facing the door and anyone who might try to enter. Victor sits on the opposite bed. He's unsurprised that Edison decides to pace rather than sit.
Miss Madsen, Victor prompts, if you please.
You do like to get right down to it, don't you?
Sophia shakes her head.
I'm sorry, but no, not yet. I've been waiting longer than you have.
Victor blinks, but nods. Taking Inara's hand, Sophia wraps both of hers around it, holding tight.
We thought something from before had caught up with you, she says. We thought you ran. It was a logical assumption,
Inara tells her gently.
But all your clothes... are just clothes.
Sophia shakes her head again.
If you were going to run, You would have taken your money. Whitney and I started an account for you, by the way. We didn't feel comfortable with that much cash sitting around. Sophia, if you're trying to find a way this is somehow your fault, you're not going to find it from me. We were all running from something. We all knew that. We all knew not to question it if someone disappeared. We should have. And the timing. There was no way to know.
The timing? Victor asks.
The event that the gardener, Mr. McIntosh?
Sophia gives a startled laugh.
He has a name? I mean, of course he does, but how bizarre. The event at the Evening Star, Inara continues. I didn't say anything about Mr. McIntosh being creepy, just about the run-in with Avery. But then we came home with all those costume butterfly wings.
I drank myself damn near insensible, Sophia says grimly. It was like being back in hell.
I took her out to the fire escape to get some fresh air, and she ended up telling me all about the garden.
I'd never really told anyone before. Why not? Victor asks. From the corner of his eye, he sees Edison's pacing stop.
At first, there didn't seem to be anything to say. I didn't know his name. I'd been so panicked on leaving that I didn't pay any attention to what was around me. I didn't know where the estate was. All I had was a tattoo and a growing fetus and a crazy story. I thought if I went to the police, they'd be just like my parents, assume I was drunk or high or screwing around and lying to avoid consequences.
You went back to your parents? She makes a face.
They kicked me out, said I was an embarrassment. I didn't have anywhere to go. I was 19 and pregnant and didn't have anyone to help me.
Edison perches on the very end of Victor's bed. So, Jilly is the gardener's?
Jilly is mine, she retorts, baring her teeth at him.
Edison holds up both hands in a placating gesture. But he is the father. Sophia deflates, and Inara leans against her for comfort.
That was the other reason not to say anything. If he'd found out about her, I could have lost her. No court in the world would have let her stay with a heroin-addicted hooker when she could live with a wealthy, well-respected family. At least when social services took my girls, I could work to get them back. If he'd taken Jilly, I would never have seen her again. And I don't think Lottie would ever have gotten over it. They're my girls. I had to protect them.
Victor looks at Inara. Isn't that what Desmond was doing? Protecting his family? You didn't think very well of him for it.
It's not the same.
Isn't it?
You know it isn't, she says dryly. Sophia was protecting her children. Innocent children who don't deserve to suffer for what happened. Desmond was protecting criminals. Murderers.
How did you escape? Asks Edison.
I was going to have to take a pregnancy test, Sophia replies. I'd been gaining weight and I was sick sometimes after lunch. Our nurse brought the test to me, but got called away to deal with an injury before she could watch me take it. I just panicked. I ran around looking for any way out I might have missed in the past 2.5 years. And I saw Avery.
Avery was already in the garden.
He'd discovered it just a few weeks before. His father gave him a code, but he had trouble remembering it. He was very slow when he put it in. That day I hid in the honeysuckle and watched him fumble through it. He even said the numbers while he pushed the buttons. I waited for a bit, then punched it in myself. I'd almost forgotten that doors could open normally.
Victor rubs at his cheek. Did you tell any of the others? She starts to bristle, but then her shoulders slump.
I guess I can see why that's a question, she admits. After all, by not going to the police, I left them there to die, didn't I?